Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, encyclical feedback. Dominican Father Robert Ombres reflects on the contents of Pope Benedict's newest encyclical and predicts its social and economic message will be a valuable resource at the upcoming Synod of Bishops on Africa, Congo rape epidemic. As church leaders renew their appeals to the government to end the systematic violence against women in the DR Congo, we hear more from a member of CAFOD about the appalling brutality meted out to so many women and how the church is helping the victims. Somalia dangers. UN aid workers pledge to carry on their work in Somalia to feed over 3 million hungry people despite threats and looting by Al-Qaeda-linked militants. And Iraqis dare to hope. The Latin Rite Archbishop of Baghdad talks to us about his hopes for the future amid the continuing problems facing the country. The richness of the Church's social teachings has been described in the past as its best-kept secret. And according to Dominican Procurator General Father Robert Ombres, Pope Benedict's third encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, proves the aptness of that remark. The document is the latest in a long line of papal encyclicals looking at social, economic and political issues. And it calls for a new world financial order guided by ethics, human dignity and the search for the common good. Let's hear Father Ombres' reflections.
Reflecting on the Pope's third encyclical, Charity in Truth, makes one think first of the old remark, which has a lot of truth in it, that the Church's social teaching was the Church's best-kept secret. It seems that despite many attempts, authoritative attempts, at telling Catholics and the world of the huge riches of experience and faith which go into Catholic social teaching, this still seemed something of a secret. And now, following on remarkable attempts, successful attempts, by Popes Paul VI and John Paul II to continue this tradition, to bring it up to date always, of Catholic social teaching, we have the latest encyclical. The key to it is in the title, Charity Done in Truth. Here the Pope is telling us that the Church's important contribution in guiding us through the many increasing, sometimes seeming overwhelming problems, economic, social and political, is the teaching of the truth. Only when do we fully understand the truth of a human condition can we love properly, deeply, and effectively. So the Church's first contribution to social problems is to tell the truth about what it means to be human, to be a person, someone of body and soul, to be in community, the truth about justice and the common good, the truth about full development, about life in God. And this is partly the work of reason and partly, greatly, the work of faith. And in looking at Jesus Christ, in offering Jesus Christ to the world, we make real human development possible for everyone because we give them the truth and we invite love.
Father Ombres also looks at the link between economics and justice and predicts the encyclical's social message will be a valuable resource at the upcoming Synod of Bishops on Africa, being held in the Vatican this October.
Two of the main elements which flow from this telling the truth, which enables real love, charity, to take place, is to speak of justice and the common good. This means having a sense of love, charity, which goes beyond the intimate and personal face-to-face, as it were, and takes an institutional path involving politics and law and society. That true is a form of loving, although it may not be so familiar in the language of today. Many themes crowd this lengthy encyclical. Globalization is a marked feature and on the increase of a modern world. But as the encyclical observes, the modern world may bring us closer, but it doesn't make us brothers. So perhaps the migrant is an image of this. Do we befriend him or her, or are they just closer to us, physically closer, but not humanly closer? Then there is much attention, of course, paid to economics, and important things are said there. I think, for example, of how justice affects economics at every point, or how every economic decision has a moral consequence. We mustn't think of economics as some vast impersonal system, the workings of a market with its own laws, which escape human control. In economics, too, as in everything else, we must think of the true good, the real good, of a human person in society. Already we can see much interest, even outside the church, has been taken in this latest encyclical of Pope Benedict XVI. And no doubt it will be taken note and used at the October Special Assembly of the Synod of Bishops, which will deal again with Africa. The theme there will be how the church can be at the service of reconciliation, justice and peace, themes which obviously connect very much with how does one love in truth. One will expect then careful application to the specific realities of Africa of the Pope's teaching. Africa, which in all its variety, in all its differences, as well as illustrating dramatically some of the world's greatest problems, is also full of resources, not only economic, material resources, but more importantly, for those who want to love in truth, human resources, cultural resources, and the resource of a growing church. That too is a resource of Africa, for Africa, and for the rest of us.
That was Dominican Father Robert Ombres. The Catholic Archbishop of Kinshasa has renewed an appeal to the government of the DR Congo to bring a halt to violence against women as a weapon of war. Archbishop Laurent Monsengwo Pasina said the cycle of rape is particularly opposed to the African culture and urged government forces, civil society, human rights activists and religious groups to mobilize against this violence. Hundreds of thousands of women in the DR Congo have been raped by rebel forces and government troops during the ongoing conflict there. UN officials said the sexual violence in the vast nation is the worst in the world. And right now it seems that women are being systematically attacked on a scale never before seen there. According to a report from the Catholic Church's Justice and Peace Commission in the Archdiocese of Bukavu, this mass incidence of rape is being used as a means to inflict death on an entire community. Pascal Palmer is Advocacy Media Officer for the London-based Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD, and recently returned from a three-week visit to the DR Congo. She told me that women there are falling victims to acts of unimaginable brutality.
The conflict has raged for so long, and although there have been agreements for peace, war has broken out again in different areas very quickly after agreement. So what has ended up happening is that conflict on many levels, for many political and personal and community reasons, many different factions have managed to just eat away at the rule of law. And the further away the community has moved from being able to have a judicial system or a police system that has in the past been functioning, but now there has been potentially a generation in which it hasn't functioned, even vaguely, let alone fully. I think that is why rape is becoming an even bigger concern for the country, because no one is being prevented from doing it, no one is going to court, no one is being prosecuted.
So rape, as you said, is almost become the norm. And would you agree with those who, including some within the church, who have said that this act of rape is in effect an attempt to destroy an entire community?
I would agree with that 100%. I do believe that rape is a very deadly weapon of war, because not only, as you have said, it inflicts a whole series of physical and psychological ways of destroying women, it also is the way within that community and that society to humiliate and to get at the heart of the male population. If your partner or your daughter is raped, often what happens in Congolese society is that that female becomes rejected by not just her family and her in-laws, but then also the community. So the blame is that, what I would call an old-fashioned idea of it being the blame sits with the woman. And not just the blame sits with the woman, but with her she carries the taint of what would be considered the enemy. And I think where the real work has to be done is to ensure that women aren't seen as the perpetrators of this crime, because obviously they are not. They are the victims of a crime. And in order to make sure that those communities don't break down, talking about the idea of the death of a community, to make sure that rape and external influence doesn't then mean that there is a breakdown of family and a breakdown of community, is vitally important in order for Congo itself to keep some of the strength that it has in these very difficult times.
Do we have any idea at all of numbers here? And as far as people can gauge, is the problem getting worse or just staying more or less the same?
Of course, this is almost a hidden violence, because so many women feel that stigma and hide the fact that they are raped. When I was in Congo, I spoke to women who, in the daytime, go out to tend their land. But when they're out there, often on their own or in groups of with other women, they are incredibly vulnerable to the different groups of militia who may or may not be in the area, in the forests, in the jungle around them. And so I heard stories of these women being raped, but never telling anybody about it. And it's only coming to light sometimes when terrible infections set in, because there's been violence as well as the actual act of rape. And often it's too late for these women, both physically and psychologically. So to estimate how many women are being raped, it's incredibly hard, but I have a figure, which was from 2008, and this was in South Kivu alone, where the population is an estimated 1.5 million. But in 2008 alone, 14,000 rapes were recorded.
And that's probably, as you said, just the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely. I think all aid agencies and the UN themselves talks about the fact that this has to only be the tiniest estimate, because so many women will feel in their own societal situation and their own community situation and their family situation, it saves them more by keeping that information to themselves than by sharing it and trying potentially to go down the route of prosecution or to have their own physical and mental potential problems addressed.
Pascal, you talked about prosecution. You talked earlier about the climate of impunity when it comes to rape in the DR Congo. Why is there such an impunity?
I think that it goes hand in hand with DR Congo having had such a difficult past and a difficult present. I think that what has happened over the last decade is that there hasn't been sufficient stability for the real and deep restoration of law and order. And as law and order is vital to any community that wants fairness, wants justice, it's even harder when there's a crime that can be committed where, to the societal way in which it's treated, the individuals themselves sometimes don't come forward. So there's a cycle there, but the most important idea is the fact that you need to have political and social stability, strong infrastructure, for there to be strong law and order, for there to be a judicial system, for there to be a fair policing system that isn't based on corruption. And therefore, how are these people, how are the women going to be able to have justice in that situation?
What more could the government do to tackle this problem? The Archbishop of Kinshasa this week, in fact, renewed his appeal to government and civil society to try to halt this violence.
I think on behalf of CAFOD, that's a very difficult thing for us to speak on, because we don't work at a political level specifically in a country like DR Congo. We work within the communities, trying to do our best with the money that our supporters give us and the money that we raise to look at where the issues are, where the problems are. And in DR Congo specifically, we work with women in what's called listening rooms to try to help them get together and talk to each other about their experience of being raped and their experience of being mothers through rape, and being able to realize that they themselves are the ones who haven't done any wrong. And in that way, what the Catholic community with Caritas, with CAFOD, attempts to do there is empower from the grassroots level and to help from the grassroots level.
You presumably met some of the women who were the victims of rape during your visit. I mean, how badly traumatized were they? And if you could tell me, what were some of the most horrific stories that they had to tell about their experiences?
I think what's so shocking is that you hear stories from women who've been in these dreadful situations, and each one you're surprised at how terrible it is. And you keep getting more and more stories, and none of them are in any way any better than the previous one you heard. I went to a listening room on the outskirts of Goma. So this is a place that's had a lot of hardship. And I went to spend a day with about 15 women who have had varying experiences of rape at the hands of militia, whether they be government, whether they be rebel forces. Every story was harrowing, but there was one woman whose story stuck out to me the most. On many levels, and she was so young, she was only 23, and so it was when she was about 22 she was taken. Whilst out collecting wood to warm the food for her family at home, husband and two children, and from that moment on, for 7 months, she was held, and each day she was raped. And after 7 months, she was incredibly sick, and she knew that she was also pregnant, and she took her own life in her hands and escaped. And this is terribly, terribly violent and awful part of the story. And yet what happens after breaks one's heart also, because after these 3 days walking to try and find her village and her family, her husband rejected her. Her father and her husband's family said, "You are dead to us," because of what has happened to her. She was accused of having HIV/AIDS. She was told that she wasn't wanted anymore, and she wasn't allowed to see her two children. That, I thought, was so terribly moving and so terrible, full stop, because it's a double whammy. It's the fact that she's being hurt and then she's not receiving any of the support from her own family that one would hope and expect. And it's from there that then, of course, the community starts to break down. Her husband had already taken another wife, and he moved away from the village with her two children. So she now has no contact with those children. A few months later, she gave birth, and her little baby is full of life and is strangely the thing that's giving her the will to go on. And now she, each week, comes to the listening room set up by CAFOD and talks to other people about what it's like to be a mum in these circumstances, what it's like to have lost the love and the respect of one's family.
How difficult is it for these people to recover from their trauma? You talked about that woman there who was rejected by her husband and her father. Does she feel embittered? What does she say about it?
It was very difficult for her to speak about it, because I think the really sad thing is, and perhaps something that when we do interviews or read interviews, we don't necessarily think about the love, the broken heart that are at the center of some of the feelings that the people we're speaking to have. So, for example, she kept telling me that the thing that hurts the most is that she loves her husband. She still loves her husband. So she's hurt on many levels to do with what the experience that she's had at the hands of militia, the experience that she's had at the hands of her husband, and the feelings that one would feel in him moving on and having a new family, and her own emotional feelings of how her heart has been broken by being rejected by both father and in-laws. And so I think speaking to her, there was a great, great sadness, and there is a great sadness.
Many observers, including some within the church, have talked about a climate of silence that surrounds this rape epidemic. Is it true that it's something not being talked about as much as it should within Congolese society?
I think if you look at almost every country historically, sexual violence against women has been a very difficult subject to tackle. Congo is in no way different, but it is because of the conflict, because of this use of rape as a weapon of war in these modern times, there is a focal point on the fact that this is going on in spades in this country. And I think that you're quite right in saying that it's been something that is silent. It's almost it's a sort of silent epidemic. And it introduces, as we've said earlier, not only the breakdown of communities, but sometimes disease, as well as the disempowerment of women and the re-disempowerment of women when sometimes their lives have been quite difficult previously anyway, due to poverty, due to a patriarchal society.
I was speaking to Pascal Palmer of the Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD. One of the world's worst humanitarian emergencies is in Somalia, where over 3 million people need food aid to survive. But it's also arguably one of the most dangerous nations in the world for humanitarian workers to operate in. However, despite threats and looting by Al-Qaeda-linked militants, UN aid workers this week pledged to carry on their work to help feed the hungry in Somalia. Intense fighting between government troops and Islamic militants is making it increasingly difficult to deliver aid in the nation, where UN agencies are trying to fight cholera outbreaks and maintain food supplies to the hungry. Aid operations have been temporarily halted in the south-central town of Badoa after Islamic militants looted the UN compound there, along with a compound in Wajid. Rosanne Cholton is the acting humanitarian coordinator of the UN agencies in Somalia, and she spoke to my colleague Kelsey Brennan-Wessels about the situation there.
What we are focused on at the moment is how we can restart our operations in Baidoa, because these are focused on humanitarian life-saving actions, and we've had to suspend those temporarily with the removal of radio equipment in particular. So we are trying to have that restored so that we can start working again as quickly as we can.
Will the UN have to stop some operations or close down some offices?
That doesn't, at the moment, doesn't appear to be the case. So we haven't had to do that. What we've had to do is simply suspend operations temporarily in Baidoa because radio equipment was removed. But in Wajid, our operation there has not been impacted because the minimum security conditions are still present.
Now, how has the looting in Baidoa affected, or how will it affect the humanitarian aid?
Well, the equipment that has been taken, very much so the radio, I mean, that's the key equipment, and some vehicles. I mean, vehicles, we can have alternatives to that in order to be able to carry on the action, but the radio is critical. But happily, other items, for example, like vaccines are intact, other products that we need to use are still intact, so those have not been touched.
All right, can you tell me a bit about the security risks for aid workers in Somalia?
Yes, the security risks, I think, as we know, are high in the sense that the situation is a little bit unpredictable. But we make every effort to manage the risks effectively by having in place the kind of minimum conditions that provide protection to our staff and also prevent incidents that are a danger to them. From time to time, the kind of incident that we saw yesterday in Baidoa and Wajid occurred. But no staff were harmed yesterday. Only items of equipment and so on were taken. But staff were not harmed in any way at all.
Now, can you tell me maybe a bit about the importance of aid agencies in Somalia? What would the civilians do if the aid agencies were not there to help?
Well, the aid agencies are trying to deliver humanitarian assistance right now to over 3 million people who are in need of that kind of support. We're not able to access everybody all the time, largely for security reasons, but we are making every effort to be able to provide anyone who needs assistance with the kind of support and assistance that they need. We are also, of course, trying to do it in ways that enhance the capacity of the Somali communities to provide them the kind of services that they need themselves. But in the kind of insecure situation that we have, the aid agencies, all of those development partners who are assisting Somalia, their contribution is still really key.
That was Rosanne Cholton, a senior UN humanitarian official in Somalia, talking to my colleague, Kelsey Brennan-Wessels. In Iraq, is there a risk that the country might slide backwards into the worst of the sectarian bloodshed that has killed tens of thousands since the US-led invasion in 2003?
That's the question some are asking, following a spate of bombings there against mainly Shiite targets in recent weeks. The overall level of violence has fallen sharply in Iraq over the past year, but militant groups are still capable of carrying out frequent attacks. US troops pulled out of Iraqi cities and towns last month. But how secure can the future be for the Iraqi population? And especially for the beleaguered Christian community, who became the targets in the past of so many attacks mounted by Islamic militants. That's a question my colleague Lydia Kane put to the Latin Rite Archbishop of Baghdad, Jean Sleiman. He says many of the Iraqi Christians are still fearful of their security, but says the situation inside the nation has greatly improved of late, and there are grounds for hope.
They're frightened, but I want to tell them the tactics of politics change. They have to be a little bit patient, and if they really analyze the provenance was there, they have been protected. If you compare the bombings and the results, you see really the hand of the providence. It can have, we could have more casualties, more destructions. I think the help of providence.
What about those Christians who have left and would like to come back but still feel that they can't? They still feel that the security situation means that they can't return?
Really, as churches, as Caritas, we are trying to do something to help those who are still in Iraq as those who desire to come back. We are focusing on development to help these people. We are very challenged. Now, I think we have to be more optimistic. Sure, we have from time to time violence again, but generally the situation is better, and we enjoyed this year a time of peace, and it helped us to think on rebuilding, not only on taking care of ourselves. So it's also a message for Christians not to lose their hope.
There's been a lot of changes recently in the country. The American troops have pulled out a lot of their troops out of the country.
Yeah.
How is that affecting the daily life on the ground in the country? And do people feel now that they it's their own country now, that they can govern themselves?
I think the daily life is the same, but the results are more politics than in the daily life. Politically, many Iraqi can be proud. We begin to be more free, to be more responsible of their country.
Finally, Your Grace, of course, we had the terrible tragedy of many, many, many priests that have been killed, but also Archbishop Rao, who was found dead last year.
Yes.
He left a legacy of someone who really wanted to promote dialogue between
yes.
between different communities. Again, is that something that you'd like to work towards?
I think Archbishop Rahu is a victim of the fight for dialogue, for unity, the unity of Iraq, and it's a very important message. I hope all Iraqi leaders will hear this, to remain united, to deal with the political actions peacefully. They have rules, they have constitutions. So they have all to deal with politics as democratic nations. But it's important not to forget their unity and not to act only for their own communities or their ethnical or religious communities. It isn't a good future for Iraq, these divisions.
The Latin Rite Archbishop of Baghdad, speaking to my colleague Lydia Kane. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.